And welcome to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I am Mike Honig, your host. Bob Gartner is on engineering. I'm always appreciative of that. And you can go to my website at thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org, and you can get links to the articles, most of the articles, if not all of them, that I'm referring to tonight or hope to refer to if I get to the topics I have planned. But it is open forum. You don't have to talk about what I'm talking about. I'm just going to throw out some thoughts. Phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. I sometimes wonder, does that actually work when you give the letters that are on the telephone keys? I'm always translating
them.
Depends
on how fast you hit the buttons.
Yeah, and of course there are some phones now that don't have the letters on the keys. They just have the numbers. So, but anyway, 713-526-5738. So, before getting into the one or two main topics I was thinking of discussing, just reading an article before I came in here about the mess in Iraq and Syria. The United States is backing the Iraqi government and some clans, and Iran is backing some clans and some religious militias. And, you know, for most of the time that I was growing up, you sort of had the sense that the political meme of the time was that if they could just solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue, there might be peace in the Middle East. I think that that meme has been pretty much blown to hell. There are so many different ethnic and religious and even clan issues. Man, they're just going to have to work that stuff out on their own. You know, I think that as long as there isn't a significant physical or existential threat to us or our allies, man, we need to let them work their stuff out. So that's that. Apparently now there's talk of sort of an unholy alliance between John Kasich and Ted Cruz, that the way it's supposed to work is in states where John Kasich is strong, Ted Cruz won't spend a lot of money campaigning, and vice versa, so that each one can play to their strength to try to deny delegates to Donald Trump. Well, we'll see how that works out. Or, you know, if that was done in business, that would be like illegal collusion of an oligopoly situation. It's unbelievable. Let's see what else. Here, random thought, not original to me, but I thought I would throw it out. If the opposite of a liberal is a conservative, is the opposite of a progressive a regressive? Something to think about, things that make you go, hmm. I wish I could say that was original to me, but I looked it up and it's not. But it is nonetheless thought-provoking. Do we have a caller on the line?
We do. It's Jerry.
We do have open lines, 713-526-5738. Jerry, why don't we start off with a chat with you? How are you doing tonight?
And
hi. Yes, you are on the air. How are you doing?
Yeah, okay. I'm doing all right. I just... And I'd call in. Yeah, I think the thing with I think Trump's actually got that pretty much right. I think that is a really pathetic attempt.
Well, pathetic doesn't mean ineffective.
Yeah, but it's not. There's reason to think that it may not be very effective either. like tomorrow, there's going to be several elections, and Trump's looking extremely strong in nearly all of them. And, you know, there's this fantasy out there among Republicans that he will show up with 1,237 delegates or whatever, but, you know, that's not, you know, he's actually still well within the realm of possibility for him. Now, it wouldn't be easy, but is it doable? Absolutely.
Well, you know, there are, of course, issues with delegate credentials, where doing various parliamentary machinations, some of which are not particularly ethical, they can deny some credentialed delegates. There was an interesting quote in a CNN article called "Cruz Kasich Alliance, Will It Work?" And they quoted one guy by the name of Tom Wiles, a Trump-leaning voter in Buffalo, New York, who said, "If the Republicans don't lay off this man," meaning Trump, "I will never vote Republican." And I think this speaks to the potential fracturing of the Republican Party. And, you know, in living memory, this kind of thing has not happened to one of the two major parties. In living memory, there have been like movements. You know, you had like Eugene McCarthy, you had like Teddy Roosevelt with the Bull Moose Party. He was running for another term, sort of splitting off a little from the Republicans. But the parties themselves have always looked like they would remain pretty intact. And the Republicans at this point are not looking that way. And of course, as a Democrat, it's easy to kind of be tempted to cheer on this kind of fracturing, but you have to also consider that the Democrats cannot be unaffected by this. For example, you've had some Democrats now that are considering that maybe we should be reaching out to liberal Republicans to bring them under the umbrella of the Democratic Party, and that sounds good in principle, but in practice, that's going to change the character of the Democratic Party inevitably. It has to.
Well, I don't know. I think that your real problem is that you know, everybody sits there and says this is an existential crisis, or could be an existential crisis for the Republican Party. But the reality is you know, we've got quite a bit of road still left between here and there, and I don't think that Republicans, you know, I don't think most Republicans are, you know, quite as bright as I would like, let's say.
We have some very bright but misguided Republicans. I don't want to impugn their intelligence, just their perspectives.
Yeah. But what gets me is, this is something that I brought up, that I kept bringing up years ago, and once again in debates with people like Barry and stuff like that. The Republican Party is extremely divided on some really key issues. And the problem is that those are gut issues for the people who, you know, things like immigration are gut issues for the parties involved. For the moneyed interests in the Republican Party, really what they want is, you know, basically to have a lot more people come into the country, preferably more educated and all that.
The Republicans? The Republicans?
Yeah.
Well, the Republicans would prefer that immigration comes from Canada and Northern and Western Europe.
Well, that's true, but that's not going to happen. The problem is that we know where we're going to get these people from and all that. But what they do want to do is they want to make sure those people are well-educated. You know, basically, you know, you're not only talking about a brain drain out of some countries, maybe some third world countries, but also you're talking about, you know, some serious capital flight issues potentially.
Well, we also have to be careful in terms of framing this in only a modern context. The fact is, going all the way back through archaeological history and beyond, there have always been human migrations, and the migrations have been caused by climate change, whether it's drought or cold, or they've been pushed out by more powerful forces, or they've run for their lives because of ruthless leaders or raiders. So there have always been migrations. The difference is, in the last 500 years or so, you now have nation states that have increasingly firm borders. And all of a sudden, this age-old multi-millennial tendency for human migration is now facing national borders and national governments as an obstruction to what up till now has always been challenging, because you always have people moving into an inhabited area and this conflict, and eventually things usually settle down and merge and cultures get mingled. But we have now this new wrinkle of the national government. And, you know, in living memory, that's perfectly normal. In historical time, this is actually an aberration, but creates additional problems.
Well, you know, I think that basically, you know, back in 1648, when, in essence, we had the creation of the modern, you know, basically we more or less set up the modern state system in Europe. The thing is that what you have is that basically people did move around, but they didn't move around that much. That system was still, you know, societies were, you know, geographically fairly stable.
Well, they moved on foot and horseback. That was kind of limiting.
Yeah. And, well, you know, I mean, you could get on a ship and really go places, but that's just it. You had to get on a ship, basically. You know, or like you said, horseback. And, of course, the only people who had horses were people who had money, or, you know, who, you know, the only way you could get a horse is if you had somebody who had money who was willing to, like, let you ride their horse or whatever.
Mm.
But
I mean, basically, we're agreeing it was slow, it was difficult, and the radius of migration, for the most part, was probably within several hundred miles.
Yeah, but, well, probably wasn't even quite that much on average.
Depended on the level of desperation.
Yeah, yeah. If you moved like that, there was something, you know, basically it was, you know, you were doing it to survive, in essence.
Most people, until maybe the 18th or 19th century, most people died within 25 miles of where they were born and never left that area.
Yeah, that's just it. And see, that's what people don't understand. And it's kind of like funny to me, even though I'm a liberal, I sort of have a certain level of sympathy with certain people on the right or conservatives who basically sit there and say, you know, we've got to control our, you know, basically our borders and all that. And, you know, you're seeing this problem in Europe. You're seeing this problem, you know, it's not this big of a problem in the United States, but you certainly are seeing people who support Trump and some other people who are sitting there saying that it is.
I think the problem is that people are always more comfortable with other people like themselves. And the people now wanting to immigrate are culturally, linguistically, religiously, culturally, just totally, I'm not going to say totally, but are very different from the majority culture. And that's, for a lot of people, scary. I mean, I have to admit, even being sort of enlightened and multicultural and a little cosmopolitan, I have to say that I have reasons for apprehension about too much of an immigration of people that are really, really different, too much, too fast, but they come at the rate they come. You know, the disaster occurs at the rate that the disaster occurs. Jerry, I'm going to give you a minute or a few moments to say the last word, and then I've got several other callers I want to get
to. Oh, you do? Okay, good. Now, I just wanted to say one other thing, and that is I wanted to bring up a book by Seymour Hersh. I sent you a couple of links about it called The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. It's a Verso Press book, and all that. You may remember some of the controversy around that.
There's always controversy.
Well, but you know what I mean. It's and everything. Basically, his narrative of what actually occurred in terms of finding bin Laden and killing him and doing all this other stuff is very different from the White House version. Mm-hmm. And there's also some other interesting things in there, too. That's only one part of the book, but
maybe the next time we talk, you can bring up that point specifically, and we can go into that in a little bit of detail.
Oh, okay, well that's fine, and let you go since you got some other people.
I appreciate your calling, Jerry. As always, take care.
Yeah, thanks. Bye bye.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Remember, you can always support KPFT. It is a listener-supported station. We don't take advertising. We're community-supported, community-run. Most of us are volunteers, and we need your help to keep the lights on, in some cases, literally. So you can go to kpft.org and click on the tip jar and make a contribution, whatever you can afford, whatever you think is reasonable for yourself. And, of course, if times are tough and you can't do that, I appreciate your listening. You can also go to my website, thinkwingradio.com, or, alternatively, thinkwing.org, take you to the same place, And you can see more information every once in a while. I'll publish a thought piece, and I always post my plans for the shows that I do from week to week. So let's see. Before I take the next caller, let me just mention another point I wanted to bring up. There was an article in Newsweek called Closed Set, Sunday TV Talk Shows Overwhelmingly White Male. I have a lot of stuff kind of pasted in here to read and scan, and you can see it on the website. But I think one of the most telling pieces is Media Matters, a progressive watchdog group, recently issued its annual study showing that white men represented 31% of the population in 2015. I'm not sure where they kind of get that number. But comprised 59% of the, really, okay, white men as opposed to males. 31% of the population is white males, but 59% of the faces and voices on the five main Sunday shows, 63% on Face the Nation and Fox News Sunday, 60% of the guests on ABC This Week, 56% of CNN's State of the Union, and 53% of NBC's Meet the Press. The numbers were only slightly better for 2015 over 2013 and 2014. And Media Matters executive VP Angelo Corazone says Chuck Todd has been making noticeable changes in NBC's Meet the Press since taking over from David Gregory, but the shows mostly fall into the habit, and I think he means all the shows, of repeatedly bringing back guests with whom they are comfortable. So just wanted to throw that out as an additional topic. I have a couple of other things I'll bring up in the course of the remaining part of the hour. And Gary, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hey, Mike, I'm good. I was hoping to call in before Jerry, so I...
You got to dial faster, man.
It was something to chomp on, but I keep track of current events. I read the paper every day. I stay up with the news, and I just wanted to announce that I have solved every problem in the world.
Mazel tov.
Every problem in the world with just two laws.
Okay, let's hear your solution if you were king.
If I were the king of the world, number one, I would outlaw religion, and number two, I would mandate contraception.
Okay, the Russians, the Soviets tried one, and the Chinese tried the other, and neither one had a satisfactory outcome.
Well,
I'm with you on the theory.
That's what I'm just kidding around with. Think about it. Think about the problems caused by my two main complaints, religious zealots and
yes,
overpopulation. And they seem to go hand in hand, sort of. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about the Middle East. There's an interesting article, an editorial in the Chronicle the other day about, you know, Saudi Arabia and Wahhabism and how they have really instigated, unintentionally perhaps, but a lot of the radicalism. You know, women can't drive there, but I just learned that if they're riding in a car, they cannot wear a seat belt because it might reveal their contours.
Wow.
I mean, how primitive can a culture be that they not only cover their women in black bags, but they can't even reveal their contours, let alone drive or vote.
Well, in fairness,
that's religion. That's pure.
That's religion, but I want to be fair and point out that you have similar things in fundamentalist sects of Christianity and Judaism. Most religions, at their fundamentalist best or worst, basically men are the victims of attractive women who basically tempt them into acts that they shouldn't do, and therefore we must cover the women up so that the men are not tempted. That really is essentially the premise of all this, is men are pure unless women corrupt them.
I want to be clear about religion. It had its purpose. It helped to civilize humanity and educate humanity and bring us all into line. However, there's a point where you drop Dick and Jane and Dr. Seuss and move on to Shakespeare.
Well, I think that the point you made, the word you used as the key word, is zealotry. People are entitled to believe what they want, but, you know, I am a big proponent of the saying that your freedom ends at the tip of my nose.
But you mentioned nations.
Yes.
The entire nation of Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. Of course, we've got divisions in Afghanistan, but they are based on a certain zealotry. Women can't even pray at the Wailing Wall in Israel because of the Orthodox religion.
Well, but this was also very common sorts of stuff until well into the 19th century in Europe. I mean, religious wars were fought, and if somebody won, the victor forced everybody to change to their religion.
And I want to say something about horses.
Okay.
Well, Jerry pointed out that only the wealthy had horses, and he only goes back 400 years. But I think Genghis Khan had a few horses. I think that the Cherokee and the the Sioux and the Apache and the Comanche had some horses.
Well, I'm going to interrupt on...
If you want to talk about migration and its impact on Europe, how about European migration's impact on Sitting Bull and Geronimo?
Well, one of the first things I want to say about what you were talking about is until the Spanish came to the New World, there were no horses. The horse had gone extinct in the Western Hemisphere, which actually makes... the Native American command of horse riding and horse raising all the more remarkable, considering that there were no horses before about 1500. So there's that. I also let that slip by me when he said that only the rich could have horses. Actually, horses were common. Obviously, the very poor couldn't afford them. But if you worked land, you had animals. And a lot of those animals in the Eastern Hemisphere, in Europe and Asia, were horses. So... yeah, it's always the danger of making a generalization.
Yes, but you were right. I wanted to commend you for your observation of the historical aspect of human migration. It's simple, pure biology. It's been going on for literally millennia.
Yep.
Not centuries.
And maybe even hundreds of thousands of years.
You might ask Neanderthal how the hell they got to Europe.
And how they got wiped out of Europe, too, for that matter.
There you go. All right, enjoying the show. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Remember, you can support KPFT by going to kpft.org. We rely on your donations to keep the station going. Click the tip jar, mention Think Wing Radio, and contribute whatever you can. Okay, the next caller, and we do have some open lines, by the way, 713-526-5738. I try to get everybody on before the end of the show. Scott is up next. Can we get Scott on? Scott,
hello.
You're
you
on the
me?
Air. How you doing?
Fine, yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, I have been reading obituaries for the Republican Party. I don't believe them, not this year. In fact, I would not judge that by a presidential year. I would put more credence in an off-year election. And Republicans certainly did make a comeback in 2010 and 2014, and no telling what will happen in 2018.
Well, I think that the reason that people are talking about the potential fracture of the party is that you have a lot of these really, really dramatic ideological and philosophical differences that they've been managing to paper over for about the last 10 or 15 years, and it's kind of coming to a head. Now, do I see an end to the Republican Party? Probably not, but I think there is the possibility of an end to the Republican Party as we know it and a fracturing off of some other political entity that will name itself. And I think that we're going to go through a period of some, I'm not going to call it chaos, but some political uncertainty with a lot of political movement before the party situation settles down again.
Well, I'll have to see what happens in 2018.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm inclined to think there'll be a Democratic president in 2018. But the strategy in 2009 was for Republicans to relentlessly oppose a Democratic president, and they kept that up, and it worked for them, too. Although Obama got reelected anyway, and I think a good part of that is he had very good campaign advisors like David Plouffe and David Axelrod, and they knew how to get the vote out in places where they needed it. And they raked up more than 270 electoral votes. In fact, they got over 300.
Well, I think that there are important numbers that we need to keep in mind, and they bear repeating, that a plurality of people self-identify as Democrats. I think it's something like 35 or 39%. A smaller number self-identify as Republicans, something like 32 or 35%, something in that area. And the rest consider themselves either Democratic-leaning, Republican-leaning, or undecided. When you get down to it, I have what I call my 40-20-40 rule, which is that 40% of the electorate will typically always vote for a Democrat or Democrat-leaning candidate. 40% will always go the other way for a Republican or conservative-leaning candidate.
Okay, I can agree with that.
And 20% is what's in play.
Yeah. Well, 2010 and 2014 revealed some very serious weaknesses in the Democratic Party. You don't have as many don't seem to have as many Democrats who go by the neighborhood school every Tuesday and every Saturday to see whether there's an election.
Well, the biggest problem, I mean, aside from the fact that Democrats, in my opinion, are the silent majority in this country because they self-identify, but they don't turn out to vote so much. But there's also the problem that in 2010, which was a census year, the Republicans won a large number of state legislatures and were able to gerrymander their states so that you have a majority of voters voting Democrat, and yet you have massive Republican majorities in state legislatures and the House of Representatives. Statewide, Democrats tend to do better because they can't gerrymander a statewide election.
Well, now, 2010 is the year when Democrats could have elected legislatures to do redistricting, but they didn't.
Lost opportunity.
Redistricting happened mostly in 2011.
Yep. Basically, the voters, that's what I was saying. The Democrats, silent majority, they just don't tend to show up like they should.
Yeah. And if they don't show up, they don't have as much say in shaping the party either.
You know, one
and
of the
you
things.
Know, there's,
go ahead.
There's a lot more Republicans running for president than there are Democrats. I think that's an effect of the Democratic apathy.
I think it's actually more an effect of the philosophical fracturing and the level of ambitious or the number of ambitious people that are currently on the national stage on the Republican side. I want to mention one thing. You know, before the New York primary, a challenge was put out, and eventually both Clinton and Sanders responded to it and visited public housing. And I think that kind of thing is really important, because when people in a lower socioeconomic class who tend to feel like whatever they do doesn't help them, when they feel like they're getting the attention of high-level political people, I am hoping that the outcome of that is that more of those people that usually feel hopeless that don't show up to vote will, in fact, suddenly feel a little hope and show up to vote.
Okay, but those are presidential candidates, and
they have to go down ballot, too.
Yeah, the down ballot races do matter, because we have separation of powers.
And the down ballot, actually, it has been argued, and I tend to agree, that the down-ballot candidates actually impact your daily life much more than the senators, congressmen, and presidents.
Yes. There are some judicial races I'm interested in Harris County. I'm interested in judges who have gladly performed gay marriages.
I actually tend to give some weight to endorsements from the GLBT.
Yes, I've
caucus.
Been active in that.
I think that they're really
ever since it started.
It's thecaucus.org is
right.
The name of the website, and I found over a period of about 5 years, without even realizing it, that I kept going to that website, and I found that most of their endorsements sort of coincided with the kinds of people that I like, because really we're talking about a right to privacy, a right to individual freedom, a right of equality under the law. I mean, those are things that matter to every Democrat, and it should matter to Republicans, and they say it does, but in practice, not so much.
I was treasurer of the caucus in 1992.
Well, I'm sure they appreciated that. Okay, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your calling. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Bob Gartner is my engineer, which I always appreciate. He does a fine job. And remember to support KPFT. Go to kpft.org and click on that tip jar and tell them that Think Wing Radio sent you. We have open lines. The phone number is 713-526-5738. Before I take Kevin, who is the next caller up, I want to mention it just came across because I kind of have been keeping track of this whole nuclear power thing a little bit more than I used to. It's actually been, last month, it's been 5 years since Fukushima. I mean, let's put that in perspective. 5 years ago, I could still, almost with a straight face, still tell people I was middle-aged. That's how long ago that was.
And you could eat tuna.
Can I not eat tuna now?
I quit eating years ago.
Western Pacific tuna we might want to give some thought to. The Fukushima thing is so bad that an optimistic estimate is that it will have been cleaned up, and you can define that term any way you want, it will have been cleaned up within the next 30 or 40 years. In other words, they're talking 1 to 2 generations. In the most pessimistic outcome, it might take until the beginning of the next century to get it under control. And under control means things like ice walls to contain radioactive water in the ground. We're talking about containment devices. Apparently, the radioactivity around the buildings is so great that it is not safe for either man or robot. Destroys the robots. They keep sending in these custom-made single-purpose robots, and the ionizing radiation breaks them down. So this is still like a real thing. This is still a real news story. So I've kind of come down solidly against nuclear power, especially given the fact that technology exists for, in my opinion, better solutions. Okay, we've got Kevin, who's really been patient. Kevin, are we going to get him on the air? Not quite. Sorry. Okay, there we go. Kevin, you are now on the air. How are you doing tonight? Thanks for calling.
Hey, Mike.
Thanks for being patient.
Boy, you got a lot of topics out there, for sure.
Yeah, there's always stuff to talk about. I usually only get to about a quarter of the things that I intend to mention.
I would appreciate y'all, because this really helps for folks to, you know, get the discussions out there.
Thank you.
I'll just throw it out there, you know, for the election stuff that will... You know, those two guys are going to pretty much implode what's left of their efforts to go against Trump. That's already imploded.
You're talking about Kasich and Cruz.
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, fun to listen or watch tomorrow.
It's going to be the most interesting national political convention in the last 40 or 50 years.
Oh yeah, it's comical. So like when Buckley. He passed away going into 2008. William F. Buckley, he said, the party has lost its soul. It will have to retreat into the forest, the tundra, for the next 30-plus years to even resemble the party it was.
Well, you know, the thing to remember is the Democratic Party is the oldest continual political party in the world. That's remarkable to think. But originally, the Democratic Republicans, which are now the Democrats, the oldest existing political party in the world. But it's worth noting that they're not the same party that they were when they were the Democratic Republicans. And they're not the same party that they were in the 19th century as Democrats. Yeah. And they're not even the same party that they were before Herbert Hoover. So
exactly.
The name is one thing. But the political and philosophical stances of the party are another thing. On the other hand, the Republican Party in American history is a relatively new party, but the oppositional politics to whatever you want to have called the Democrats since, you know, 1791 or whatever, you know, we've had the Know-Nothings and the Federalists and the Whigs. And so we've had parties that died. But, of course, the people don't go away. They just realign. And that's also worth remembering.
That's
so
a good point.
You may have a Republican Party that will still call itself a Republican Party, but after 2016 or 2018, they may be a very different Republican Party, and there may be a competing party going for the people of those ideology, and you may end up with some people left on the fringes just kind of doing their own thing. We're going to go through a very interesting time, and of course, as the Chinese have been known to say, may you be cursed by living through interesting times.
Well, you know, thanks for all that. I think that's a good history of it for sure. I spoke with Mike, I spoke with Jeff a couple weeks ago about that. You
yes.
know, I made a percentage amount of the establishment being, you know, big business backing Hillary, being Republican. I went and dug up the article. And it's an analysis of the Federal Election Commission records by Time Magazine. And it was actually 2015 that it showed that 70% of, you know, the campaign contributions to Hillary Clinton was from the Republican CEOs like the Koch brothers and Goldman Sachs. And this year that Goldman Sachs to Hillary's campaign, hers is more than the whole Republican Party total. And then, of course, we know the other corporations that she backs and such. So the party's going to splinter. The Democrat Party, well, I think, will go into two factions. You'll have the neocon, that's, you know, the 36 years.
I'm sorry, Democrats or Republicans?
Democrats. You'll have, I told Jeff, 36 years of Bush, Clinton, you know, with, you know, Obama in there, the last part. But that's the establishment. What I mean by that is, you know, big business has, you know, a vested interest in making sure that, you know, stability, you know, continues. So this year, you know, to hear David Koch say that, you know, well, you know, she's more stable than, you know, Trump. Well, Trump isn't Hugo Chavez or Castro, even though those are, you know, I would say, you know, state actors. I would say Trump is a state actor in the sense that he's 1%.
Trump is the most Mussolini-like candidate
Thank
I have
you.
Ever
you
seen.
You read my mind, man.
Yeah, I mean, he's not—he's not a Hitler, but he is absolutely
Mussolini.
A Mussolini.
Mike, you hit the nail on the head. He speaks what the populace wants to hear because the establishment can't say it. Clinton can't say it. She comes around because she has to counter Bernie.
His popularity is based on the racists and haters feeling oppressed in their perceived freedom of speech to express hate and racism, and it's like, thank God we finally have a candidate who expresses our hate and racism.
Right. Well, it sells and it gets the vote because if you have a party that's built on, you know, when you hear about, you know, our forefathers or, you know, Axelrod, you know, in Huffington Post is, you know, the great grandnephew of Trotsky. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know where to begin to start on this, but.
I'm
you know,
sorry. Are you being facetious, or is that
it's on Huffington Post about three
That's
years
a genealogical
ago.
Case.
You know, he's biologically the great grandnephew of Trotsky. I mean, it's long, you know, people would say conspiracy, but the point I would say is this establishment of money and the structure would be the Democrat Party will splinter into which has already been for the last 36 years, conservative neocon with the Clintons and Bushes, and then the progressive, which will be your young voters for Bernie. And that's what we're seeing right now with the fracturing within the Democrat. The Republican is just, like you said, I think it's all a joke. It's you know, McCain, who can't even get a handheld tell without doing all the propaganda films for, you know, the Viet Cong or Bain Capital, which all Mittens does is bust up companies for liquidation profit now.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm not sure I agree. I'm not sure
Americans, baby, that is just, like you said, mostly. But I'd like to just dive into the Middle East, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
And then when you talk about the Wahhabis, that's not organic. There wasn't the radical neo-caliphate. You know, you can look back at, you know, Muhammad, and yeah, he was a bad guy, and I'm not backing these people, but you have to engineer and corrupt within. That's what the Ottoman Empire, that's what happened to the Ottoman Empire. And so you have Arab Spring, and these are all the Middle Eastern countries, you know, that are now imploding. It's called Colored Revolution. And these Wahhabis come up, and they're in Syria. And if you follow the 83% of the oil that leaves north of Baghdad, it goes through ISIS and on routes. This goes to Israel. So if you want to know who's buying those, you know, those not forerunners, what are those, the vehicles that funds ISIS, you don't have to look no more.
Well, they do seem to favor Toyota.
Yeah, well, it's the, I can't remember what it's called, Land Cruisers. I'm sorry, the black Land Cruisers.
No, they actually like the little medium-sized pickup trucks.
Well, what I'm saying is the majority of the black market oil that leaves North Iraq through the Kurdish Northern that goes over to the maritime, to the Mediterranean Ocean, then goes straight down to Israel. That's where the funding is. And it's a long story there. But this Arab Spring is the buying up of, you know, what's left of the British, you know, the Middle East, the East Ottoman Empire, and now this is all fractured out. And so the Exodus, which is the creation of the migration of these folks, you know, you got Saudi Arabia below you there, and you got all of the land. But for some reason, these European countries that are fracturing on their, you know, tarp bailouts to each other, you know, in a circular fashion.
Well, even Belgium now is there's a faction in Belgium, and there's always been, but it seems to be gaining some strength to break up Belgium into the
Switzerland.
What is it? The Flemish and I forget the other group that they have there.
So all these in the forefront in Hungary and Sweden, the first waves. These are
okay. You are talking about Hungary, right?
Yeah, we're talking Germany. We're talking. All these European countries are getting hit, and I don't know if they don't talk, why they don't talk about all the rapes and the sexual assaults. And these are young military-aged men. They're not all women and children.
They had some problems in Germany, I think, what was it, during the New Year? One of the things I want to just mention, and I'm probably going to let you go after this. I'll give you a last word. It has been my contention for a while now that really – the First World War, the Second World War, the Cold War, the Arab Spring. To me, looking at it, all of this is a 100-year war that started in around 1914. Because all of this stuff that we're seeing, almost all of it can be traced back to the outcomes of the First World War, including what you mentioned about the European colonization of parts of the Ottoman Empire. Well, ultimately in 24, but it started in 1914 with the war that destroyed the empires, that caused the division of the empires, that caused the colonization by the Western Europeans of the Ottoman, of portions of the Ottoman Empire. All of that stuff is still sorting itself out.
And it's actually with, you know, Lawrence of Arabia and several other folks that infiltrated the Ottoman Empire and start fracturing out, and didn't have the Sunnis. The Arabs weren't fighting Arabs back then. You didn't have a radical neo-caliphate. So your divide-and-conquer strategy when the West Indies were being taken under, when, you know, British were busting them up, they parlayed over also the Ottoman Empire, and which was the most powerful empire for 550-plus years, half a millennium. But you don't hear about that in your textbooks. They didn't have radical... I mean, this Orthodox priest goes up to these schools and talks about never in the history of the Jewish world was there more safety in the Ottoman Empire. They had their own Jewish statue, their own government. They pay tithes to, it's a certain name for, you know, paying tithes to Caesar.
Yeah.
But this rabbi preached about there was no safer place and time in the history of the world for the Jewish men other than in the Ottoman Empire. But the British invaded Ottoman Empire and divided it up and fractured it. And that's your Wahhabism that went south into Saudi Arabia, who was given, you know, and I'm not going to say who created them, but it's another, what I'm trying to say, Mike, is it's, yes, history might give us a certain, if you actually look at the factual history, how the British blew up the Ottoman Empire and fractured it from within, creating these factions, the Sophies.
I don't think that they created the factions. I think the factions had been suppressed for hundreds of years, and you take the lid off. That's kind of what's going on. And it happened in Europe, too. You know, you take the lid off, like in Yugoslavia, and all of a sudden all this stuff is like, where did this come from? And you've got the problems in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Slovenia and Croatia and Kosovo.
Who caused those arms to those folks that were killing all those Christians?
Well, let me point out, and then I'm going to let you go. I'm sorry, but I'm going to point out that
I appreciate you. Let me talk.
During the Second World War, if you watch the old war movies, one of the complaints that you often got in the war movies from the soldiers was, "We shot down that Zero, and that engine was made in America, or that scrap iron we sold to Japan, and now they're shooting it back at us." And, you know, now we're actually selling them the missiles and the planes.
Well, you know, the first tanks were made by Opel, which is GM, and Hitler had all his Volkswagens ported in New York, and the first computer for the way stations during the internment camps was IBM. The SLA, Service Level Agreements, Freedom of Information Act, showed every 30 days IBM went to go fix the keystroke.
I'm going to let you go, but we can talk again next time.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Take care.
Right, good night.
Good night. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer is Bob Gartner, kpft.org. Tip jar is how you help keep the station on the air. And we do have open lines. We still have about 12 minutes. So if we move along, I can get two, three more people on at least. 713-526-5738. Next one up is it Gray?
Hey, Mike, listen to the show as always.
Thank you.
For the last couple of weeks, but I wanted to get in tonight.
Okay.
I don't know if you got, not this current issue of Time where they have like the 100 most influential people, but the one before it, where they were talking about the national debt, where they had the, you know, if you were a subscriber, they put your name on it and how much you owed.
Oh, I saw that cover.
They had a piece in there called The Billionaire, and I think The Billionaire versus the Bigots, or The Billionaire and the Bigots, about Donald Trump and how many either white supremacist groups
mm-hmm.
or racial identity groups, especially the racist mm-hmm. racial identity groups, have kind of flocked to him.
Yep.
And I was listening to, I guess it was NPR last week, and one of the things they brought up, they had an interview with George Wallace's daughter.
Yes.
And she said, and a couple other people said, that yes. they're almost parallel to 1968.
I don't remember. I think it was Rachel Maddow who first brought it up, the resemblance to the Wallace campaign in 68, and I think Lawrence has jumped onto it, and a number of other commentators and reporters have begun to explore it, and I think that Wallace's daughter was interviewed by Lawrence.
Yeah, and she was also, I think, on radio recently talking about how basically what Trump has done has made it popular to say what a lot of people think. Her exact words were, he says what a lot of people think,
mm-hmm.
but they'd never have the courage to come out and say it.
You know, up until about the year 2000, one thing that I said frequently was that we had finally come to a point, about the year 2000, we had finally come to a point where racism was about as civilized a behavior by most people as spitting on the sidewalk. That it was considered uncivilized. It was considered a little lower class and barbaric. And, you know, people are entitled to think what they want to think, and they're entitled to talk in their own homes about what they want to talk about. But I do think there is some value when hate and racism are considered topics that are not polite conversation. It does help to prevent spreading the seed. And
yep.
I think Rush Limbaugh started really pushing that envelope. And you know, the term political correctness is a right-wing focus group tested term that unfortunately Democrats are really bad about adopting Republican focus grouped terminology. And he started attacking this political correctness. Well, we can't say what we really, really feel. You know, we should be able to talk about, you know, if we don't like something. And he's the one that began, in my opinion, to really push that envelope that made more and more people and more right-wing talking heads feel that they could express on a large medium this hate, this racism, this anti-immigrant feeling. You know, one of the things that I'm asking all the time is when people say we need to seal our border, it's okay. What do you consider sealed? Because we're never going to get zero illegal immigration. So you can always complain about illegal immigrants. At what level do you consider it to be an acceptable amount of leakage? Is it 1 or 100 or 1,000? What is it? And I've never gotten an answer from any conservative.
Yeah, you're never going to be able to seal the border. And it's always interesting to me how some of the same people who want border security are the first ones who,
cut
whenever
the
you do come up with a reasonable solution, they always use some kind of obstacle in its path.
Oh, it's always money. It's too expensive. It's too expensive. We you know, because government has to be small, so we want to seal the border. We just don't want to spend the money. And then we can continue complaining about the border not being sealed. The conservative strategy for a couple of decades now has been complaining that government doesn't work, making sure that they fund it inadequately so that it doesn't work, and then saying, you see, government can't get anything right.
Mm-hmm.
So they create the problem they complain about and then complain about the problem. It's really insidious. It's diabolical.
It is. It is. And I think this election will kind of show people, you know, what's really behind some of the things that we've been seeing over the last 25 to 35 years. I mean, that's what this is. This is, Ronald Reagan used to say it was called not feeding the beast.
Was it Reagan or was it, I can never remember his name. The guy who said that he wants to make government small enough that he can drown it in the bathtub. Grover Norquist.
Grover Norquist is who you're talking about.
Yeah, I think he was the guy who came up with that don't feed the beast comment. Might have been Reagan. Doesn't matter. Somebody on the right. And that's what they do. You know, the post office, they complain bitterly about the U.S. Postal Service, but they've done everything they can to bankrupt it, to make it perform less well, and then they complain it doesn't perform. It's a constant strategy. You get the government you pay for. That's one of the things I keep saying. You get the government you pay for. You strangle it, it fails. Okay, Gary, or Gray, rather, do you want to take a few moments for a last word?
I'll just say how much I enjoy the show, and I'm going to give some money to KPFT to keep your show in the air.
I thank you so much for that. You take care. I appreciate it.
All right.
Have a great day, a great night, Gary, and maybe we'll talk. Oh, Gray. I keep calling you Gary. It's like a dyslexic thing.
Well, yeah, we'll hear from me again.
All right. I won't forget. Great. Take care. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Okay. We still have about six minutes, and I've got Scooter waiting online, and I can probably take at least maybe one more call if you call in if you want to talk. 713-526-5738. Scooter, you're on the
Hello.
Air. How you doing?
Hello. I was really interested in your analysis of the World War One to the present situation.
What do you think of that?
I think that Wilson was probably the most monstrous president we ever had, a Democrat, and his decision to join in with the British, who were an absolutely monstrous. Imperialist, like just destructive a force in the universe, compared to the Germans, who were pretty much gave us labor unions, the reform Jewish movement, pretty much everything, resisted religion, everything that you could possibly imagine as a progressive. He joined that side.
Well, of course, the
what
irony.
Do you think about that?
The first thing to consider is the irony of the United States joining the British, because up until the First World War, the feelings about the British dated back to the American Revolution. They were not well liked. They were considered arrogant.
For good reason.
Yeah. Well, for lots of reasons, not the least of which was that before the First World War, I think the British were the largest single international investors in the United States. You see movies about how Americans felt about British visitors and, you know, owning stuff in the United States. And because at that time, the United States was a debtor nation. Up until the First World War, the United States was a debtor nation. We owed more money than we had, and we were appealing and looking for international investment, which the British, because of our language and cultural similarities, were more than happy to give us. And I think that, I mean, it's interesting when you start to frame it the way you did, that when the United States came into the First World War on the side of the British and the French, up until then, nobody really wanted to help the British. You know, the Second World War already would sort of like become new buds.
Well, yeah, you had to. It was horrible.
But the First World...
You had to come in at that time.
But
we created it by joining the British side. We should have gone in with the Germans.
Well, of course, hindsight is 20/20. We could have just stayed out of the thing entirely and let both sides bleed themselves to death. And, you know, that might have actually put us in an even more powerful situation from a cold-blooded sort of geopolitical internationalist perspective. But I think that Wilson, and, you know, Wilson had his flaws, and he had some good things about him. He was a racist, but he was also kind of a socialist. So, I mean,
And a racist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a flaming,
insane racist.
No one is perfect. You know, no one is perfect. And remember, you have to judge people by the era in which they lived.
Well, actually, that era was the turning point in which he could have made a difference.
But he was an older man who had spent most of his life in the 19th century, the majority of his life in the 19th century. So, I mean, you have to kind of look at people in the context of their times. In some ways, he was very progressive. In other ways, he was very regressive.
What his name one?
Name one what?
How he was progressive.
Well, he was an...
Well, he crossed unions.
Well, now you ask me a question, so let me answer it real quick. He was an internationalist. He believed in ethnic self-determination. He did not approve of empires.
What does ethnic determination mean?
Well, in other words, one of his rationales for breaking up Austria-Hungary was that they oppressed or controlled many different ethnic groups, nationalistic groups. And it was his feeling, for example, Serbia, which had sort of triggered the First World War, they claim.
Right.
And his feeling was that you should give these different peoples, the Czechs, the Slavs, the Serbs, the Romanians, you know, that they should have their own countries, with the idea that by allowing these nationalities to express themselves in a national way, you might actually have more peace. You wouldn't have, like, the Germans saying, but there are Germans over on the Austrian side that we need to protect, or the Russian side, and the French saying, well, there are French over on the German border, and we need to protect the French. And by realigning the national boundaries, that was his plan. He wanted...
But in the meantime, he was trashing South America, Latin America. It was, you know, a disaster. I mean, he was a total imperialist. And to make an argument that he needs to save Europe is like crazy.
Well, you know, cultural. What do you call it? I normally have a word for this. Basically,
racism. I call it racism.
Well,
you can call it whatever you want.
You know, you can call it racism, but not everything is about race. I was having, and I got to go soon.
We
were having a discussion, me and actually a guy who was doing some handyman work for me, very bright guy, enjoyed the conversation with him. And he brought up the term, I think it was him that brought up the term colorist, that most racism is not racism, it's colorism. So even within racial groups, you have people that favor a color over another color, even though they are technically, if you want to use the term race, of the same race. Anyway, I got to let you go.
Okay.
Thanks so much for calling, Scooter. You take care. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I thank the callers. I thank the listeners. I thank any contributors, kpft.org. My website is thinkwingradio.com. And remember, this is from Bruce Barton. It takes a real storm in the average person's life to make him realize how much worrying he's done over the squalls. Take care. Jazz Latino up next.
With Juan Flores.
Have a great week.
KPFT invites you to a celebration of the acclaimed program Democracy Now! And the extraordinary movements and heroes who have moved our country forward. So join us for a visit by Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! On Sunday, May 1st at 1 p.m. Amy Goodman will speak in Houston at the Carl Walker Jr. Multi-Service Center, located at 4300 Noble Street. Visit kpft.org or our Facebook event page for full details. You're encouraged to purchase tickets early because this event is expected to be at capacity. So visit kpft.org for tickets. Proceeds from this visit by Amy Goodman benefit KPFT Houston. Support KPFT by donating your unwanted vehicle. No matter if it's a car, motorcycle, boat, or RV, when you make a donation, your vehicle is resold at an auto auction, and the proceeds help to support KPFT programming. To donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. And your car doesn't always have to be running either, but it does have to have an engine and be towable. And you must be the legal title holder. There's no cost to you, and you help out the station you enjoy with your vehicle. Cost to you, and you help out the station you enjoy with your vehicle.